All right!
Coming to you from the frozen tundra deep inside the basement of champions.
Canada!
The Dean Somerset Podcast. Now, the man who puts the FU in functional training. Here he is, Dean Somerset.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Dean Somerset here with the Dean Somerset Podcast. Today, I've got a very special guest. He's a good friend of mine that we finally got to actually meet in real life. For those who are on the internet, they say that's IRL. Mike Israetel. Mike, how's the world treating you today?
Good. Thanks so much for having me on.
My absolute pleasure, man. For those who don't know, Mike and I got to actually meet at the L2 Fitness Summit in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. How was your trip to Edmonton? How was that for you?
Amazing. I love Canada. I like everything about Canada. Canadian people are, if you have never seen any, they're at first so nice that it's creepy. You think they want something from you and they're all in a cult, but it turns out they're actually just that nice.
We truly are. I mean, have you been to much of Canada before that?
I have been to a lot of Canada before that.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
So I did most of my growing up in the Detroit metro area in Michigan. So a lot of our summer vacations were spent in Ontario, and I've been to Windsor a lot. I've been to Hamilton. I've been to Grand Bend, and I've been to Montreal like once, I think, and like some stuff around in Quebec a little bit, and most recently in Edmonton.
Very nice. So a lot of the east side of Canada, but not so much in the west. What do you think are some of the big differences between the east and west from what you were able to see?
Man, you know, I couldn't pick up on a whole lot. I will say that the Quebecois are quite a different people from the Anglophone Canadians I think there's some cultural differences as well. Quebec is a bit different, but I honestly, if you drop me off in Edmonton versus if you drop me off in Hamilton, I don't know if I'd be able to tell the difference unless I looked at a map.
No, we're pretty close to similar all across. I mean, there's obviously some cultural stuff with Quebec and the Maritimes, Bo, and that, but hey, I'm glad you had fun while you were up here. So in the seminar, we were doing a whole bunch of talking about things like assessment on my day, hypertrophy on your day. First off, just a little background on why you're so well-versed in hypertrophy talk. What led to you being in the field that you're currently in and getting a PhD and lecturing, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so like I was a high school wrestler, and I wanted to start training weights so I could be better at wrestling. I ended up falling in love with weightlifting, or lifting weights, not the sport of weightlifting formally. Yeah. And then I got to college, and I started powerlifting, and I got sort of really impassioned with trying to become stronger. So I ended up doing a master's degree in strength and conditioning, exercise science at Appalachian State University, and right around that time is when I started reading some more bodybuilding magazines, and I started to really develop a passion for just getting jacked. And I was a personal trainer in New York with Nick Shaw for a year, and then I decided that I needed more education, so I went and did a sports science PhD under Dr. Mike Stone at East Tennessee State University. And by the time I got there, I was already fascinated with hypertrophy, and I tried to learn as much as I could about it. And during that time, I started competing rather unsuccessfully in bodybuilding, but I continue to get more jacked and more lean, so hopefully I can be a good competitor one day. And it's just something that just there's almost kind of a religious fascination with me with just sheer lean muscular size, and I love everything about it, and I love the lifestyle of training and eating, et cetera. So for me, it's not just an academic pursuit. It is a personal pursuit as well.
True. I mean, when I met you, you're probably one of the thickest human beings I've ever seen. And I mean that in probably the most applicable way possible. You're not a small dude, that's for sure.
Well, thanks so much. I tried to fix being small for a really long time, so I'm glad it's working.
So in terms of like development, I think that's kind of an easy way that a lot of people kind of get into things. They start training for something else and they fall in love with the sport of just weightlifting and getting strong. I mean, I remember I tried to fix an ankle injury on my own and wound up going down the route of like Flex Magazine and Muscle Mag back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So that's what got me kind of hooked into it too. So definitely have a
for sure. For sure.
So let's start with actually, like, what happens to create hypertrophy? Let's say you've got somebody who's a brand newbie in there and they're doing whatever they can to get stronger. What actually happens to create hypertrophy? What are some of the cardinal laws that have to take place?
Well, there has to be a stimulus, and then there have to be the conditions that allow for recovery adaptation to occur. Mm-hmm. The stimulus has to be usually some form of resistance training, and of which the most important part is actually volume, like how much of it you do. And intensity is a factor, but a little bit more complicated of a factor. We could talk about that in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to lift weights, basically. And then after that, you have to make sure to support your lifting weights with enough calories and enough protein fundamentally, and, of course, some other more minor things in order to actually literally provide the building blocks to expand muscle tissue. And I think that second part a lot of people miss, because they think, oh, I'm training, I'm going to be gaining muscle. Muscle isn't gained from thin air, and you're not going to give up stomach proteins and brain proteins to get bigger biceps. Your body just won't do that. Mm-hmm. So at some point, you have to be eating to assist in the growth process, and a lot of times what makes a big difference for people is that nutrition. And of course the training and the type of training, et cetera, plays a difference as well. But as long as you have that stimulus and that supportive recovery adaptation through nutrition and rest, everything else is now a question of exactly what ways in which do we go about doing those things.
Mm-hmm. So anybody who's walking into a gym, as long as you're training some level of resistance training and eating enough to support muscle growth, they're going to see some gains. Now, how is that something that's that would be different for somebody who's more advanced, like, say, somebody in your category or a Mr. Olympia bodybuilder? What kind of things would be different between their approach and somebody who's a beginner?
The biggest difference is the attention to detail, because some hypertrophy is no longer something you're looking for. When individuals become more advanced, their proclivity for adaptation starts to go down. Their resistance to adaptation starts to go up. And when you have enough of an adaptive resistance, things that are just okay no longer work. To use kind of a ridiculous analogy, you know, if you are trying to swat a fly, any amount of force that comes from your hand on the fly is probably going to kill the fly. If you're trying to, you know, kill a predatory bird, let's say, that's stuck in your house and trying to attack you, you can't just, like, swat at a predatory bird. You have to, I don't know, hit it with a rock or hit it really hard or choke it. If you're fighting, you know, a cheetah, you may need a weapon of some kind. And if you're fighting a tank, you need an anti-tank missile from 2 miles away. So the level of intervention, the degree of specificity and exactitude of the weapon you're using has to rise with the nature of the challenge. Advanced training, advanced lifters are very, very much challenged to gain any muscle, so the precision of the instruments they use has to be very, very high. What I mean by that is just training isn't good enough. The number of repetitions you do, the amount of sets you're performing, the kind of weights you're using, the way in which you execute exercises all start to matter more and more and more. And we're taking into as for granted that we're quote-unquote training hard, right? Training hard is never going anywhere. No one's ever debating it. But those added layers of detail start to matter more and more for two reasons, really. One, the more advanced you get, and two, the worse genetics you have, right? If you have really good genetics, seemingly everything can work for a long time. It is those of us who don't have really good genetics and or are more advanced that need to become more and more particular about the kinds of training interventions and, of course, nutritional interventions that we take.
Mm-hmm. So in order to see the difference between, like, a beginner and intermediate, obviously there has to be a whole lot of tracking and data going into that. If you're seeing somebody who's in the gym who doesn't keep a workout log, what does that kind of do to your emotions when you see something like that, especially if they're trying to be serious about seeing changes?
Yeah, well, so that last part changes the nature of the question considerably for the better. You know, I'll put you this way. It's a two-factor question. If they seem to be satisfied with their gains and or they're just lift recreation or the blow off steam after work, mm-hmm. I have no problem with it whatsoever. But if they complain about a lack of gains that is consistent and they still don't track their workouts, then I'm simply baffled. And usually if they ask my advice, they say, like, what do you think I should do today in the gym? I've actually had questions like that. And I'm like, what did you do last week? And they're like, oh, I don't remember, I think. And I'm like, okay, I'll just cut you off right there. Already you have a problem, because logical structuring of workouts, using one workout to potentiate for the next workout, having a structured sequence is one of those fine details. It is the rocket launcher against the tank that we have to have at the higher levels. And if you don't have one of those, then you're going to just simply not be able to guarantee that you're going to get gains at all. So absolutely, I think tracking and using a notebook or using some sort of app. The app I use is the Notepad in the iPhone. I just record all my workouts and make sure to periodize and plan according to that. And you know, so if you're not writing stuff down, I can tell one of two things. You're not serious and you don't want to be, which is totally fine, or you are not progressing very well and you are not prioritizing very well.
That's true. I mean, the old adage of what matters gets measured definitely plays out in this. Aside from things like sets, reps, and exercise, what other information do you think somebody should be tracking if they're looking at putting information into a workout log? What are some of the key ones that you'd want to see?
Proximity to failure for hypertrophy, repetitions in reserve. I was going to say you want to track technique, but that should really just be standardized. If you get more advanced, you can track particular kinds of machines that you're using. Like when I travel, I make a note to say where I trained so that I know not to scale the machine weights from the last workout, but just kind of find their own little repetition ranges. Like, for example, if you're like doing lat pull downs as a second exercise in your back program and you have to travel somewhere and use another lat pull down machine, you look at the repetitions that you were using last week, and you just kind of try to pick a load that's going to replicate similar repetitions with a close reps in reserve. If you use the exact weight, it just be like the other machine is rustier, then you're just you're basically using a level of information that is inappropriate to the task. So sometimes you have to keep track of fancier things like that. But I say sets, reps, weight, exercises, repetitions in reserve, and of course, actually the number of microcycles that you have been progressing with a movement. Clearly, you know, there's the mesocycle level of analysis, and you have to deload every now and again. So keeping track of that and managing your fatigue, keeping track of fatigue, usually through reps in reserve, I think is a really good basis.
True. And on that point, maybe somebody who might be listening has no idea what the term reps in reserve is. So could you elaborate on that a little bit and go into it?
Yeah, totally. So like when someone says I did four sets of 10, the first question is, oh, how hard were the sets? You know, and people say, what do you mean how hard? But well, look, if you had a gun to your head in every single one of the sets, how many reps could you have done before literally not being able to complete anymore? And, you know, there's a very wide answer. If you bring like a housewife to the gym for the first time and you let her, in most instances, not all, self-select a load and do sets of 10, you'll be like, okay, if your children are a burning building, how many reps can you do here? They're probably 30, you know, but if you let like a bro come in and self-select sets of 10, he's probably going to get like 8 reps on the last set because he went to failure and did, you know, 11, 10, 9, 8 because he went to failure in every single one of them. So reps in reserve is how many repetitions do you have left to true muscular failure on any one of the sets. And generally speaking, anything less than about 4 or 5 repetitions in reserve isn't sufficiently stimulative to produce a lot of hypertrophic results in especially intermediate and advanced. But any time you consistently hit failure, especially with the majority of the sets in your program, more than 1 or 2 microcycles in a row, it starts to accumulate a disproportionate amount of fatigue relative to the hypertrophic gains you're getting. It's just not a sustainable way to train. You can only go to failure so many times in sequence, week to week to week, until you just literally start dropping off in performance and start losing muscle and are just not gaining any. So I think that magic zone for most productive training is between, you know, 1 rep or 0 reps in reserve going to failure and all the way back to about 4 reps from failure. I think it's a good idea to start every progression or most progressions in hypertrophy training 4 or 5 reps away from failure, slowly adding weight to the bar or adding sets to the number of movements you're doing. And after a couple of weeks, 4 to 6 weeks usually, you finally hit failure in that same rep range, deload, repeat the process with either bigger loads or different exercises.
Sure. So you shouldn't be training to absolute failure on every single set that you do in the gym, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can. The thing is that the fatigue problem comes up, right? The amount of fatigue that's going to affect your later sessions, later that week and especially the next week, is really high, but the amount of extra hypertrophy you gain is very low. Now, it's pretty clear from the literature that you do gain more muscle training to failure than not. But the thing is, you only gain like maybe 5% more muscle. But if you train to failure, you get something like double the fatigue. Yeah. It's just not worth it. It's the difference between sustainability. I think a big thing that is really good to remember is that – can you still hear me okay?
Yeah, you're coming through well. You kind of cut in and out there, but you're good right now.
Yeah, Yahoo. Thanks, Skype. So a good thing to remember is that training is a long-term endeavor, and training has to be done in a sustainable fashion. There are 2 questions you have to answer before coming in to train. What am I going to do today, and how is that going to affect what I do the next session, and the next week, and the next month? Both of those right now and later questions have to be answered. You can't come in and just be like, let's fucking smash it, balls to the wall, bro, burn it out. Okay, what about next time? Burn it out again, right? Can you burn it out just as hard next time? Well, no, you'll be too beat up. So the next – this workout will be very overloading. The next one, by definition, won't be as overloading. And then what? The next one won't be overloading at all? You're literally just walking backwards at that point, right? So it's like the old – you know, it's like kids who have find a new hobby at first. As an adult, you don't want them to burn out. So you say, okay, we'll do this for 5 minutes today, and maybe next week we'll do it for 10. And just so you don't do it for 2 hours today, your eyes start bleeding from playing too many video games, then you hate video games, you'll never play them again. Similar thing in training. You have to make training hard enough, but you have to leave room for an expansion and an expansion and an expansion, because those sequential expansions, presentations of overload, is how we grow in the long term.
True. I mean, there's obviously a time and place where you want to push the envelope for fatigue, but then you also have to pump your brakes and back off for sure. And then there's also the other 10 months of the training calendar that you want to put in almost like base mileage to just be able to say, okay, I'm here doing stuff, but not crushing myself getting in there.
100%. Yeah. If you don't have any long-term considerations for hypertrophy, you've made the biggest error of all, because the key to really noticeable hypertrophy is the long-term. There's not a single bodybuilder out there on a stage that hasn't been training for years and years and years. So if you want to be super jacked, you almost by definition have to think of the long term, right? There's a variety of things, you know, I currently can do in my training that just won't support long term development, even though it'll make for cool YouTube videos now, which is why I don't do them now.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of years ago, I squatted high bar 500 for 10, and I haven't repeated that since then. Am I strong enough to repeat it? Oh, totally. I could probably squat 500 for 15 now. But as far as my, you know, participation in jiu-jitsu is concerned, and various tendons and ligaments that I have that have been irritated, it's just not worth the trade-off for me to blow my load, so to speak, doing that and then potentially get a career-ending injury, or just simply accumulate so much fatigue that I take 3 weeks away from hypertrophy training. Mm-hmm. And then what, right? So everything that you do in a training program has to be logically structured with the future and the present in mind. That doesn't mean we don't ever try, but that means we try pretty hard in the first microcycle, much harder in the second, really hard in the third, super duper hard in the fourth, maybe all out in the fifth. Then we take a deload and then we repeat the process, as opposed to just showing up to the gym and just giving it your all. The giving it your all is a noble view, but it is a very short-sighted view.
Absolutely. So we're talking about kind of the upper end of the spectrum on that. What about the bottom end of the spectrum? What do you think the least amount that a person could get away with training to still see some type of appreciable gains with you?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. You know, so for beginners, clearly that amount is like one set per week. Like anything will grow you.
Yeah.
But as you leave the beginner phase, especially after the first 6 months of training, it's going to be some, you know, non-zero amount of sets that is going to be with the minimum of what you need to grow. So for example, if you've been training for 3 or 4 years and someone's like, hey man, I got this really awesome chest growth program, it's 2 sets of chest work per week. You're just going to look at that person and be like, you really think that's going to grow my chest? And they're like, of course. It just violates the whole idea of dose response relationships, right? It's like you've been recreationally drinking in college, you know, for 3 years, and someone's like, dude, one shot of this stuff is just going to get you super drunk. You're like, okay, man, even if it's Everclear, that's just not going to happen, right? You know, yeah, a shot of Everclear might get like a someone who's drinking for the first time buzzed, but this is not going to happen if you're a seasoned quality Canadian drinker. You know, you've got some miles under your belt at that point. So it's a similar thing. So the minimum effective volume is a term we use, basically like in drinking terms, would be like, what's the smallest number of beers for me to start at least feeling something? You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
I mean, you probably know, just using the beer drinking analogy and taking it as far as it goes, you know, there's a certain number of beers you can have in which like it's not even party mode yet. You know, like I'm sure like I don't even barely drink, but like some guys will say like, you know, anything under 6 beers, it's just like I can just do everything I can normally, and I'm just enjoying it for the taste. Like, wouldn't it be funny if you went to, you know, like a hipster beer brewery with friends, and they're like ordered like a raspberry stout, and you were like, oh shit, time to get fucked up, right? And they're like, what? No, man, I have to take 8 of these to get drunk. And you're like, what? But aren't you gonna get just a little drunk? They're like, not really, man. You don't really start feeling anything until 4 of these. But then from 4 all the way up to 10, that's like your good range. After 10, it's all blackouts and vomit everywhere, so that's not good. But there's this like minimum effective volume if you're a seasoned drinker, where under that underneath that, you really just have nothing valuable to report. Just the same way in lifting, like if it's less than maybe for most intermediate lifters and above, something like 6 to 8 working sets per muscle group per week is for most muscles the minimum effective volume or close to it, right? If someone said, you know, you could do 3 sets of bench press a week and progress, doubtful. If someone said you can do 8 sets of chest work a week to progress, you'd be like, okay, you just, now you've got my interest. I think that'll do something. Just a quick reminder, though, minimum effective volume is the minimum effect, right? So people, you can't be like, okay, I'm just going to train a minimum effective volume all the time. Well, you're just going to get minimum gains, right? The idea, I think, with training is to start most of your programs at the minimum effective volume, given a couple of training variables like exercise selection and rep ranges. Given those kinds of variables, you start at minimum effective volume and you slowly, over the course of weeks and months, work up to your maximum recoverable volume, deload, change some variables, and repeat that cyclic process. That way you're always in that range of growth and you're never too high on the one end where you're overreaching too much, and you're never too low on the other end where you're at the party and you're still 6 beers drunk and everyone's having way more fun and you're like, I don't know, I think I'm just going to stay 6 beers drunk. Well, totally, you're just not going to pull any fire hydrants out of the ground that party. And you know, what's the fun in a party if you can't like pull a stop sign out of the ground and stab yourself with it?
I love how you absolutely equated alcoholism and bodybuilding. That's fantastic.
Listen, people can have fun and it's not alcoholism, okay? Look, unbelievable. Immediately the moralizing begins.
Oh, no, no. I'm not saying there's a problem with that. It's a solution. Like, alcohol is a solution.
You're like, right? I'm using alcoholism in the Canadian sense of this is a fine thing to do, and most people are alcoholics.
I mean, it's cultural, right? I mean, Canadian and Irish and like very few populations have that ingrained ability where it's like, yeah, that's how we define ourselves is through beer and whiskey. So
that's it, man. Yeah, 100%.
It's a good way to go. So if we're talking about maximum, we're talking about minimum, we're talking about everything in between. Let's say we got a recreational lifter out there who's somewhere in the middle zone of volume, but they got a busy schedule. They got all the stuff that normal people who aren't superhuman freaks of nature have to deal with, like kids and family and job and stuff like that. How can they maximize the time they have in the gym without crushing themselves or without feeling like they're just absolutely doing nothing at all?
Yeah, I think one of the best tools for maximizing time in the gym is to stick mostly to compound free weight exercises, because those give you the biggest bang for your buck by involving the largest amount of musculature. So for example, you can do cable crossovers, you can do front raises, and you can do standing tricep extensions with a cable. That is, let's say, 3 sets each, a total of 9 sets. It's going to take you some time. Mm-hmm. Or you can do 3 sets of incline barbell bench press and accomplish more or less the same level of disruption and growth stimulation from just 3 sets. So I think that it always baffles me, and I'm sure this kind of irks you too. Let me know if this is correct. When you see someone at the gym, you know for a fact only goes to the gym twice a week, and you know that she has a super busy schedule, and you see her doing like the adductor machine, and you're just like, my God, for the 45 minutes you have in the gym, there's got to be a better way to spend your time.
True. I also see the guys who do the wrist curls for endless.
Oh my God. Sets.
Yeah.
I just started training my forearms last year for jiu-jitsu and bodybuilding, and they were pretty big to begin with. Now they're much bigger. It definitely works. But, I mean, I'm talking about filling in the holes on what I'm looking to be just an exotic all-around freaky physique. Mm-hmm. And I spend 9 hours in the gym, 10 hours in the gym, just in weightlifting gym every week. I mean, if you have 3 hours in the gym, why the hell are you training? Unless you really want big forearms, right? You want to have like a mystery physique where like you roll up your sleeves at work and people are like, oh my God, the rest of them must be muscular. And then it's beach day at work and the rest of you just looks like total shit. And they're like, huh,
it's like
guess he fooled everyone there.
It's like Popeye syndrome.
That's it, man. All you need is traps, calves, and forearms, and that's it. Like, if the rest of you, people just fill in the blank with. The rest of you must be jacked. Another cool technique, if you're limited on time, is to use compound exercises and use them in an alternating superset style. Mm-hmm. So you basically – what you do is – basically it's a form of circuit training. You set up a circuit where you do one set of a movement, and then you use completely antagonistic muscles that have not been trained by that movement while you're quote-unquote resting for the other movement. So you get really good local rest. Mm-hmm. Maybe you take 30 seconds between those two moves and then cycle through it again. So for example, you set up some dumbbell presses, incline dumbbell press, and a lat pull down station. And you do incline dumbbell presses for lots of reps, and then you immediately put those down, walk over to the lat pull down, do your lat. Still with me?
Yeah, you kind of cut out for 5 seconds, but you're back again.
Cool. Yahoo. So you do lat pull downs, you do incline dumbbell press, and you switch back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You may even take 30 seconds between those two. But basically, after 6 minutes, you've got like 4 or 5 working sets of that stuff. And you've trained a lot of muscle mass without taking a ton of break. Unless you're looking for exotic hypertrophy and exotic strength, it really, you don't have to take these long rest breaks. Most long rest breaks are taken by like elite powerlifters and weightlifters that need to produce maximum forces, maximum velocities. Most training for general pretty decent hypertrophy, if you have a busy schedule, doesn't require you to rest a lot between sets, especially if they're antagonistic supersets. And another thing, a quick tip I have for people who are limited in their time in the gym, you don't have to do a lot of exercises to get a lot of volume in. Just do a lot of sets, which limits the amount of time you spend warming up and setting up various stations. Like, I swear to God, and Dean, I'm sure you're sympathetic to this, but you see a guy spend like 4 minutes setting up this exotic ass incline bench between 2 cable pulleys. He waits like 5 minutes for everyone to stop using the cable pulleys. Then he does like incline dumbbell cable pulley fly. Mm-hmm. You can't just pick up some dumbbells and do the same shit. And you know for a fact this guy's like a 3-day gym, 3-day a week gym guy. He just like misread a Flex magazine and is like, this is what's going to sharpen up my inner pecs and upper pecs. Like, yeah, if you're a pro bodybuilder and you've already done 10 other sets that day, that maybe once in a blue moon you'll do this exercise. But people will, you know, or they'll do something like, okay, I'm training legs today. I'm going to do leg extensions, leg press, hack squat, lunges, squats, sumo squats. And it's like, my God, how much do you spend warming up for the different machines or going around the gym waiting for people to finish certain machines because you need the leg extensions? How about this? Just stick to like 2 or 3 exercises, and instead of doing 3 sets of each one, do 6 sets of each one. It's the same volume of work. After a couple of months of doing the same exercises, you can switch and pick 2 or 3 new exercises and just rock on. Like when you're at the lat pull down station, use that baby up. Do 6 or 7 sets of lat pull downs, superset it with 6 or 7 sets of incline dumbbell press. You are going to be messed up, but you're just going to spend your time training as opposed to looking for free pieces of equipment.
True. And then if you spend the extra 5 minutes in between checking Instagram and texting and all that, you know, that adds up to the time.
I really kind of just count my success at the gym as how much Facebook work I get done. And if it's a great workout, but I'm not on Facebook at all, people are like, how was your workout? I'm like, you know, to be honest, it wasn't that great. I got almost nothing done. I squatted a lot, but I mean, I literally checked like 3 status updates. It's ridiculous. I don't even know what I'm becoming.
Yeah. I mean, there's always those fun guys in the gym who decide to do something like an incline dumbbell press inside the squat rack while
checking
Facebook for 20 minutes during peak hours. It's great.
Yeah, or the superset, the exercise superset that's seemingly not designed to conserve any time. Mm-hmm. So like I can appreciate, like I've walked into a rack before and there's like a lady there doing squats supersetted to pull-ups. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay. And you watch her do a set of squats, set of pull-ups, breathe for 20 seconds, repeat. And you're like, all right, lady, jam on. Hell yeah, I'll wait around and watch this. You know, this is great. But then you'll be like, hey, can I use the squat bar? And a guy's like, yeah, I'm doing squats and pull-ups though. And you're like, okay, respect. And you watch him do a set of squats, check his phone for 3 minutes, do a set of pull-ups, check his phone for 3 minutes. I just want to be like, hey, motherfucker, why don't you get the fuck out of the squat rack, go do your pull-ups somewhere the hell else. I'll do my squats. Then you can have the whole thing for squats again. So I don't know why you're supersetting. I think you're supersetting just as a joke to take up as many pieces of equipment as you possibly can. And then there's always the guy who like tri-sets or something. He's like, yeah, I'm using the chest press, lat pull down, and cable fly at the same time. Like, no, you're not. Yeah. I've actually had I would never do this, but one of my friends back in my early lifting days was a power lifter. When people said, like, I'm in the squat rack, if they weren't doing like hardcore lifting, they didn't have to be lifting heavy. Like, if they're just wasting time, he'd just be like, no, you're not. And we just remove their stuff over. And I was like, oh, shit. And a lot of times they kind of just went with it. They're like, you're right. You know, nice. Like, I didn't even want to be in here. I was hoping somebody would kick me out.
I mean, it could be worse. They could be doing curls in the squat rack, right?
And every now and again, I mean, some of those people were, in fact, like one guy was like setting up for curls in the squat rack. And my friend's like, are you going to use that to squat? And the guy's like, no. He's like, we need that to squat. And the guy's like, okay. And the guy just wandered off. I mean, like, you know, it's a dick move, but the other time it's like 2 dick moves, right? Doing curls in the squat rack, I think actually, I'll say this controversy generating statement, I think it's totally fine as long as no one needs it for actual compound heavy lifting. Yeah. Like if there's nobody in the fucking weight room, rock on. But if someone's looking for a squat rack and you're doing curls, you had better be like, hey, do you want a squat in here? And they'd be like, yes. Well, here you go. I'm just going to do curls somewhere else. And, you know, it's one of those, like, you know, if they need it, great. If they don't, hey, you know, every now and again when there's a free squat rack, your boy comes in there and I do reverse wrist curls and I put my lifting gloves on and it's the belt on and everything, put the bandana on because it's wartime when I do wrist curls, man. There's no jokes anymore.
Yeah, you got to get the Ultimate Warrior tassels going on to get the blood flow restriction.
That's the only way I train. How do you know, man? How do you know my secrets? This is disturbing.
Because you put it on Instagram, that's why.
Ah, shit. You're right.
Easy way to go, right?
Yep.
So we've got the average guys coming into the gym, doing a lot of compound stuff, doing lots of sets of very simple exercises. If they wanted to switch things up, what could they do if they wanted to? But I mean, obviously, it wouldn't be as good as what you were mentioning, but what would be some realistic substitutions they can make?
You know, like machines that allow you to move in a compound manner are really good. So you don't have to squat. You can leg press. You can hack squat.
Yeah.
I would just say that as long as you can afford it, if you're low on time and if you want the most results, just stay away from really isolation-y movements. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, try some dips. Try some JM presses. Mm-hmm. Try some shoulder presses with a barbell with a close grip. If you want your triceps to get big, there's lots of exercises like that to try before you move on to, like, single arm dumbbell kickbacks or, like, what I like to call the double dildo handle tricep pushdown machine, you know, where you, like, I don't know, the thing just shreds my elbows completely, but I've never seen anyone use that machine productively. My, one of my roommates right now is literally doing the motion and it looks perversely sexual already. Yeah. It's like you're moving a pair of phallic objects away from your face. Maybe you're practicing for real life or something, but I just, if that machine is like, it isolates things so much that it's like, it actually, I think, interferes with overload because you're not able to really generate high forces. And of course, remember, if your time is limited in the gym, why not hit two or three muscles? Why not hit your front delts too? I will say this just while we're on this rant. I think there is an over fascination with isolation that I just never understood. I remember posting some, every now and again, I'll post a lateral raise video and my traps at the top of the lateral raise tend to contract. And people will be like, Dr. Mike, aren't you worried about your traps taking over at the top of the movement? And I'm like, what do you mean taking over? And they're like, well, like it's less work for your side delts. And I'm like, I don't think it's less work for my side delts. It's just also work for my traps. And they're like, well, don't you not want that? I'm like, do I want small traps? No, this is how I train my traps as well. And it's like trying to like isolate your glutes out of the squat. Like, sorry, the glutes are part of the squat. Like, yeah. It's okay. And especially if you're limited on time, you should be looking to the more general compound movements and away from the super isolation-y ones. I think the isolation-y ones aren't as hard. They look fancy. They look fun. I just honestly believe that my first question in my mind, it's a sarcastic one, when I see someone doing crazy super isolation setup on a machine, I'm like, when's your show? You know, that's my first question. Like, oh, are you in the IFBB? And they'd be like, no. I'm like, well, who the hell are you doing that for? You know, that's, I think it's one of the beauties of like, you know, CrossFit. Like back in the day when it started, it had a lot of downsides. But I think immediately when it started, one of the beauties of CrossFit to me was, you know, they were the first people to really push compound, super gnarly basics on everyone. They're like, you're going to squat, you're going to do rows, you're going to do pull-ups, you're going to run around a lot. People are like, God damn it. But that shit works. People get in shape. I think it was one of the beauties of that system was that it got people away from doing these, because, you know, like people would think they're all bodybuilders and they'd put on the gloves and go and do leg extensions on a machine at a health club with, some smooth jazz playing and, you know, you get a protein shake from the machine after, and that's just not causing enough homeostatic disruption to your body to be worth your time.
Yeah. Plus, it's also a lot easier to set up a CrossFit gym with a couple of bars and some plates than 15,000 isolational machines that each cost a few grand each.
100%. And you know, it's funny because you could walk into a CrossFit gym and be like, so how am I going to, you know, why don't you guys have any machines? Just barbells. What's going to make up the difference? And I think the proper answer is your suffering is going to make up the difference. You're like, God damn it. I knew there was a trick.
Yeah. There's always going to be a cost that you have to pay.
That's right. Your body will be making up the effort that the machines are not there to make up for you.
Exactly. Well, I think we covered a huge amount of ground on something like this. So let's get just to touch on differences in gender. I know that's kind of a hot topic with a lot of people right now. So for guys, how much muscle would be realistic for them to look to gain in, let's say, a calendar year? I know it's kind of a broad question.
You mean in the first year of training?
Yeah.
You know, anything between, I think, if they eat properly, anything between 10 and 20 pounds is realistic. Mm-hmm. I think anything above 20 pounds is like kind of insane. Anything below 10 means you either in genetics were meh or you under 8. Mm-hmm. is 10 pounds in a year isn't bad, but the thing is, as soon as year one is over, it's going to be less than 10 pounds. It may be 7 after that, 5 to 7 after that. I think for intermediates, people have been lifting more than 2 or 3 years, but less than 7. I think a gain with guys of 5-ish pounds per year of muscle is actually pretty realistic for most drug-free athletes. When you think about it, that's not crazy, but that means, like, you know, for 4 years, you may gain 20 pounds of muscle. Mm-hmm. Not the way you look, but, you know, it's not going to be anything revolutionary.
Yeah, and that's if they're training specifically for hypertrophy and hitting all the variables they're taking care of.
What about totally, especially the food. You know, I think some people, like, really kind of get it twisted. They're like, well, you know, I haven't, you know, I say, like, you know, you can gain 5 pounds a year of muscle, no problem. As an intermediate, people will be like, well, that's kind of like a lot. And I'm like, you really think that's a lot? And they're like, well, you know, I didn't gain that much. And I'm like, well, how much did you weigh? And they're like, well, I just weighed 160 the entire time. And I'm like, did you make an active effort to eat more food than you wanted to? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, how the hell are you supposed to gain weight? Like, this means this amount of muscle I'm talking about is you have a meaningful attempt to gain weight nutritionally in conjunction with proper training. That's how you gain the most muscle. I think a lot of people are so obsessed with just keeping their abs all the time that they're surprised how they don't magically gain weight out of thin air. I think that's a big problem people run into.
True. And then what about for females? What would be a realistic rate of gain?
I think something like half of that, maybe a little less than half, is realistic. So I think if females can gain in their first year of training 10 pounds of muscle, I think that's really good. And I think that if they gain during their intermediate year, so to speak, maybe 2 to 3 pounds of muscle a year, I think that can make a big difference and it can be really good. Mind you that, you know, on a smaller female frame, that's a lot of muscle. You know, if a female trains for 4 years and gains 3 pounds every time, you know, 12 pounds of muscle is if you buy 12 pounds of steak at the store and slab it onto your kitchen table, holy crap. Mm-hmm. Like if you try to distribute that among your body, that's just got to go to some places. And that's how you get really definitive shape. I think people kind of like maybe, I don't know through what channels people think that some amount of muscle isn't enough, but you'll talk to a female who's already very muscular and she'll be like, you know, man, I only gained 5 pounds of muscle last year and I'm really pissed. You're like, 5 pounds? That's a crazy amount. You know, if you gain another 5, you'll start looking just downright freaky. And I think people kind of forget that. Maybe a little too much Instagramming is in the mix there, where people always report these phenomenal results and we all think we have to get them all the time.
True. I mean, I was in Norway and one of the girls who came up and was like, I'm making progress, but I don't know if it's enough. She showed me her before picture from 2 years ago and looking at her now, it's like she's gained about 15 to 20 pounds.
Oh my God.
Good quality muscle, like not stuff that looks like she's not taking care of herself, but like 15 to 20 pounds of athletic, very lean muscle. And she's wondering if she's gaining at a good enough rate. And I'm like, wow, you're too far ahead of the curve right now. You're going to kill yourself if you work too hard at doing this, but you're already doing great.
100%. And unfortunately, some people just psychologically always think they're behind no matter what, you know. It's funny. My fiance is not exactly like this, but she'll have her moments. I think we all do. Mm-hmm. You know, she'll just sometimes think she's like the weakest person of all time. And, you know, weighing in the like mid-100s, like 150-ish pounds body weight, she can rep out 225 for like sets of 8 in the squat. And I'm just like, okay, it's like you do realize most women will never squat 225. I think people forget about that. Like if you go on Instagram, every girl is squatting 315, but she just happens to be an elite competitor in powerlifting. And that's why the videos pop up. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I think people lose track of that. Like, you know, I don't know if you – do you prefer pounds or kilos or do you not care?
In Canada, we actually do pounds more, but kilos – we understand kilos.
In the gym sense. Yeah. So like, you know, I think this is really crazy, but I think most females, if they can get to a point where they're repping deep, strict reps with 60 kilos or so, 135 in the squat, but that's really good. Especially for females that are in, you know, closer, you know, 30 plus years of age, 30 to 40, if they just got into the lifting a little later, repping out 135 plus for deep reps, you know, sets of 8 and 10 is really, really good. And I think some females compare themselves maybe to males and they're like, well, you know, I'm not like repping out 315. I'm like, you're not a dude either. Like, so I think there's always a perennial demand and need for realism, especially in some areas of the female lifting community.
True. I mean, I know that it's pretty rare for a lot of guys to be able to rep out 225. I mean, when you look at the vast majority of the gym going population, you see somebody throw two wheels on and take it for a ride for sets of 8 or 10, that doesn't happen every day. Oh, no. Did, but, I mean, you're going to see those guys that are pretty elite who can use 225 as their warm-up, but they're the elite. They're the guys that are at the top of the game. For working in a commercial facility as long as I have, seeing the number of people who can put two bells on it and then quarter squat for sets of five and look like they're doing something, there's way more of those guys out there than there are girls who can actually squat 225 for reps.
100%.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think that listeners have gotten a huge amount of value out of this, so let's talk about the L2 Summit.
Well, it was amazing. It was hours and hours and hours of you and I rapping on about the stuff we usually rap on about. Mm-hmm. But if anyone is interested in purchasing the video from that, I'll tell you what, they may be disappointed at the shittiness of my jokes, but they won't be disappointed about the volume and depth of content, which I think it's one of those things where, you know, people think they, you know, they've listened to a podcast or two. They're like, okay, I kind of see where these people are going. When you have like 4, 6, and 8 hours of recorded video with demonstrations, et cetera, there's a quality leap there mm-hmm. as far as knowledge content. Like a lot of the stuff I talk about, I keep intentionally general for podcasts. There is no generality in a situation where I'm allowed to speak freely for 6 hours. There is tons of specifics, lots of development of theory, explanation of rationale. And I think that's the difference between having kind of a cursory familiarity with something and being able to really reason by yourself about it. Like you can watch a TED talk on some kind of subject and be like, oh, I kind of know. I can, you know, I can kind of go to a cocktail party and understand what's going on when people are talking about that subject. But when someone's like, hey, how do I actually do this? And they ask you about it. You're like, no, I'm sorry. I just listened to a podcast. I don't know what the hell's going on, mm-hmm. right? But if you have, you know, really tuned in to something that is hours and hours long that really explains the basics, really goes down to fundamentals, after you've paid your due diligence learning for something like that, now you really, so when someone asks you, hey, how does this work? You may be much more inclined to be like, ooh, you know, let's give it some thought and come up with the correct answers.
Absolutely. I mean, you did a great job with your presentation and not just talking about the Pennywise run, but also talking about
actual... there was a lot of discussion about Pennywise the clown.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny. I saw since then, I actually saw the movie.
Oh, yeah?
Have you seen the modern It movie?
Yeah, I did. What did you think?
I thought it was, first of all, amazing. Second of all, hilarious. And yeah. Third of all, I literally was never scared a single time. It was not a scary movie. It was – I want to be friends with Pennywise the Clown. Like he was awesome.
I know. It was kind of like watching Goonies.
It really was. It was – and even the clown was great. Like he was just having a great old time. He was just sarcastic and it was great. I loved it.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool movie. But you did a great job talking about that and breaking down very complex concepts into easy, actionable stuff. And I think anyone who picks this series up is going to get a lot of information, like you said, deeper knowledge base than what they would get just from listening to this little old podcast or a TED Talk or anything funky like that.
Well, for sure. And I think I do a pretty decent job of doing some practical demonstrations as well on video, but you go through your, you know, the whole development of movement assessment and all of that stuff. And there's hours and hours of that. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, it's really hard to teach on a podcast without video, sure. But with video and with taking the time to explain that stuff, and I'm sure you see this all the time, you know, in your field of movement analysis, is there's a lot of people that are like, oh yeah, I know how to do that stuff. And you're like, okay, show me. They're like, well, I've seen some articles. Again, that's not close enough. To actually be able to pull it off and apply it to yourself, you really need to invest a lot of time into learning this kind of high quality stuff. And I think that your component of the video very much offers that.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. If anyone wants to track you down and see more of what you do on a regular basis, where can they find you?
You know, I'm taking a sabbatical from social media because I've just had enough of this cruel world we live in. You know, sure. Dean, I think it's just time that I just stepped back. I'm going to go live in the maritime provinces and just start my own little fishing business. What do you think? You want to disappear with me?
You know, if you put a couple dumbbells on that ship, we could have a good old workout.
That's it, man. We'll see if the ship's rated for it. I'm at RPDRMIKE on Instagram, RP Dr. Mike, at RP Strength, that's Renaissance Periodization, the company that I co-founded, and then RenaissancePeriodization.com and Renaissance Periodization on Facebook, Mike Israetel on Facebook. I mentioned this in another podcast, but I tried to start a Twitter account, but it was already started for me using my email by a Middle Eastern spam bot.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's great. So I'm trying to get that resolved, but hopefully I'll be on Twitter at some point. For now, Facebook and Instagram will have to suffice.
That's pretty impressive. You had a spam bot take your name and email address.
It was amazing. Actually, just my email address. They didn't even know my name. So my name is like some Arabic symbol set, and it's got my email. And it's funny because Twitter's already wise to it. They're like, your account is already suspended. And I'm like, great. So my first role on Twitter is to unsuspend my account.
Nice. Do they have like a picture, or is it just the egg?
Nope, no picture.
Yep. Okay. So you're just Dr. Mike the egg.
Exactly. At least there's no picture yet.
That'd be awesome if it was like a picture of your roommate and you were just like, what the heck is going on in the world? All right. Well,
yeah, exactly.
Well, if anyone hasn't checked it out yet, I'll be putting up a link to pick up the L2 Summit. Check out Renaissance Periodization. Mike's an awesome guy to be able to learn from. Mike, it's been a pleasure having you on here today.
Dude, thank you so much for having me on.
My absolute pleasure. Take care, man.